You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 83. If I can see it and believe it, then I can achieve it. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, today on the show, I wanted to talk about the state of self-distribution, the state of film aggregators in the wake of the distributor debacle. And I wanted to bring on a guest to really talk about not only the business of where it's been, where it is, but also where it's going to go. And today on the show, we have Klaus Bedelt, and he is the founder of FilmHub.com, which is a new model and new technology that's helping filmmakers get their films out into the world and actually generate income from their films while still maintaining complete control of their product, of their film and catalog. And I wanted to bring Klaus on to discuss a lot of the stuff that's going on with Distributor, how you can protect yourself, how you can get your movie back, how you can file a copyright claim with these platforms if Distributor does not release your film back to you. There are multiple ways of getting your movie back, at least control of your movie back, and then figure it all out as far as the money you're owed. But at least the most important thing is to get your movie back. And you really need to move very quickly on this, because if they do file for bankruptcy, it will be very, very complicated and difficult for you to get those movie rights back or to get access to your movie back to be able to put up on these platforms. But we go over this, we discuss different distribution models, and of course, we talk about the filmtrepreneur method of how to become an entrepreneurial filmmaker. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Klaus Bedelt. I'd like to welcome to the show Klaus Bedelt. How you doing, brother?
Great. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And we're going to get deep into this whole distribution and distributor thing. And I really wanted to kind of pick your brain about distribution in general, self-distribution, and all sorts of other cool things we're going to talk about. But before we jump in, how did you get into the film business?
Yeah, so quick story, 18 years I had the first tech startup. At the time, we didn't call it a tech startup yet. Back in Germany, it was like IBM and stuff. So I sold that at 24, realized I need to do what I always want to do. That's music and that's film. So I sold my shares, went on to, to do film music. I came to Hollywood, so to say, Los Angeles, end of 90s. I was on vacation, got stuck here, then had a career, if you want, as a film composer. I did over 100 movies, I think, by now, including Pirates of the Caribbean. I did the Beijing Olympics closing ceremony. I did Time Machine, worked a lot on Gladiator. So many movies. None of those which are on your wall in the back. No.
No, those are all my movies, sir. I'm sorry.
Okay, good. So
it's all about me, sir. I'm sorry.
And you see, I have no posters. I have to always look up myself on IMDb to remember what I did. So it was just, it's a big blur in the last 20 years. And then just a few years ago, obviously I worked in the industry a lot. I worked in with the big studios here, lots of major motion pictures, but my heart really belongs into like independent film. I did a lot of films in China, in France, indie films here, of course. And I realized that there was a big paradigm shift in how we watch movies. Video streaming came up. It's not that long ago that, you know, we had DVDs, right? I mean, it's still do. Mm-hmm. And I saw also, because I'm a musician too, I saw what happened in the music industry before. There's a democratization going on that you, as an artist now, didn't need these record companies. I was in the music industry before film industry. I know how crazy that industry is, how hostile to the creator. And I saw, in a way, the same thing. I worked on movies which never saw the light of day, never got out wide or at all. And I wonder, this is so great what we're doing there, what others are doing. Why not? And now, since everyone is video streaming, there should be no more, nobody in between. Nobody telling you your movie is not good enough or no audience for this or making deals and suits. And I found this whole industry. I'm a very anti-corporate guy. I believe in creators should have the power. And that's how I got into, like, put a team together and said, well, let's do something where we use technology. I'm an old techie, as you now know, and using technology to bypass this old system, which is, by the way, of course, that system which, you know, wrote me the checks all the time. But so I did this fine balance between, look, I'm still an industry player, if you want, like I still work in the industry, but also have the knowledge, I would say, to disrupt it from the inside.
Very cool. I had no idea that you were so deep in the composing space, sir. I had no idea. I thought you were a tech guy that was into distribution. So the marketing is working, sir.
Thank you. Awesome. Yeah, no, that's great, because it's funny, when we went to Silicon Valley to do all the pitches, etc. It's hard for people to understand or believe that I do both.
Yeah,
but it's very common in our, especially in music, you have all these writing music for, especially for movies. It's a very thorough craft, and it has to do with math. There's a lot of technology involved. I mean, I came here first time. I worked with Hans Zimmer at the time, and I said, "Well, what are you guys doing? Why do you have all these? Let's use computers. It's so much faster to write music with. It's leveraged the technology." And we went from, I don't know, I had like 50 samplers and, you know, mixing consoles.
The Neve panel. Yeah.
Which I still love, don't get me wrong. But you had to write, you know, film music means change. That's what I learned here, right? It means change. It's always going along with the directors, with the writers, with the editors. It's not to like defend your music and say, oh, but this is better. No, you need to make changes. And for that, you need computers. Otherwise, it's like writing on paper. You know, you're not recording this on 2-inch tape, right?
So, oh God, I remember those days as well. Jeez. No, but isn't it true that every composer that lands in Los Angeles has to go to Hans Zimmer's office? Like it's part of, you have to, or else you just don't work in the business. You have to walk in, spend time there, and then you're allowed to leave. It's kind of like the doorway, isn't it?
Actually, you're not allowed to leave.
If you're lucky, you escape. If you're lucky, right. You escape.
You pass by God, and and on the way you. No, I mean that was also for a while a great place to. I thought of democratizing. You know, I'm always like this. It wasn't at the time a power play. It was more like, you know, nurturing your talent. Of course, you learn that, you know, ultimately it's, well, I don't want to say too much, but it's not ultimately about that there. But I made it like that for me. I learned a lot there. I wouldn't say I learned writing music, but everything else around it. You don't get out there with relationships, but that's always, I mean, that's now maybe my advice to young filmmakers, not only film composers. There's two ways of doing things to me. It's like either you, I don't know, you intern for the big guys and you work your way up inside that system and until you have you have some real chips and you get out and then you do your own thing. Big plus is you get in fairly quickly if you have the way in. Big minus is it's almost impossible to escape the big gorillas. On the other hand, there's this, what I saw with others, and I actually said that too, you find, I don't know, a student director or, you know, as a composer or as a director, find a student composer and grow together and build a partnership if you trust that person. Those relationships happen too, and then they're beautiful and for long term, and there's really trust in for the creator and built in.
Yeah, like Burton and Elfman and Spielberg and Williams, like these guys, that's what they do. I mean, I think Williams, I think was one, I think the last one he didn't do, or there was, I think he's done pretty much every Spielberg movie, but I think either the last one or one of these, he just, and it was, I don't know. Pretty much it's always there. He's always there.
And I tell you a little anecdote, I mean, I don't know how much time you have, but Steven Spielberg sat next to me and said, I cannot believe you guys let me listen to the music. Because here's how it works with Johnny. He sees him twice, once when they watch the movie and then on the recording stage. Actually, three times. Sorry, I'm lying. After a few weeks, he goes, I think he's invited for dinner. Then Johnny plays on the piano. And Steven says, I have no idea what's going to happen. I've totally lost control. I have everything under control on the film, right? But not music. So it, for him, especially, it's a big, big trust game. Now, okay, today we have more technology. We can play music. And I always did this as a part of filmmaking, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a handful of key creatives on the film and you build this together. It's like the quintessential multimedia project.
Multimedia. I haven't heard that term used in quite some time. That's, yeah, you've dated yourself, sir.
I mean, come on, I have more stories. I know too much and not enough to be dangerous.
So I'm going to have to ask you back so we can have a whole episode just on your journeys in Hollyweird and your composing and all that stuff, because we could just sit there and talk about Johnny and Stevie all day. But today, the reason we brought you on is because, you know, you are an expert in the distribution arena with the company that you run, Film Hub. And, you know, we were brought together by this unfortunate debacle that is Distribber and the horrors that has been going on in the film industry because of it. So first, what are your thoughts on this entire Distribber debacle?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of companies in our industry, which to me, even Distribber counts into this old school. This is kind of a newer school, but old school. Here's the difference. So we have distribution companies, aggregators. Distribution companies to me are service businesses. Mm-hmm. You pay them and then they take some, but ultimately they want your money first, right? I mean, I've seen distribution, it's not with Distribber, but distribution deals a lot where you pay upfront or they withhold. It's a bit like music recording artist.
Or as a post-production house, you're paying for a service.
Paying for a service, right. And you have no control over how it's been spent. That's the worst to me, right? So you accept that like a distribution company does marketing. But, you know, they talk to you, but you have no word.
Maybe
if you're lucky, they talk to you. So Distribber is to me like the, not next generation, but like the same thing. What I think is wrong with this industry that aggregators or distribution companies are very similar to me. They provide service. They don't open access, but they just vie for your money. Mm-hmm. And there's something inherently wrong with this. Now, they have very, very little value to add. That's the problem, right?
There's a doorway. It's just basically they're just gatekeepers. That's all they are.
They're gatekeepers. And now, what's better about aggregators and the distributor is that they don't say no so much because mm-hmm. their risk is financial risk is relatively low compared to distribution companies who can only take like I don't know 10 movies a year because they have to put the human resources behind this and the lawyers and make contracts is very complicated and they keep it very complicated. So it's a bit more streamlined how Distribber did it, but still it's service, which I think like why? what is in that. There's not much value. Now, the problem when a company like this goes out of business, and I don't want to necessarily say like, look, yeah, I saw the writing on the wall. They were not like kosher or something. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, it could have been fine. And if you're willing to pay to play, that's kind of like this thing, right? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, then you still see this. Look, I'm touching so many grounds. Sorry, but we have to re-educate us filmmakers to get way of thinking of trophy thinking. Like success and getting into Sundance is the trophy. Getting a signed deal is a trophy.
I call it the lottery ticket mentality.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very similar. Like you're always looking for that lottery ticket that's going to give you everything that you've ever dreamed of, which is like I get into Sundance, I get a huge distribution deal, and then Marvel, Kevin Feige is going to call, and I'm going to do the next Marvel movie because he saw my $5,000 independent film at Sundance, which I shot on my iPhone. Like that's the delusion. That is the delusion of us filmmakers. I made a whole movie about the delusions of filmmakers because we're crazy.
I'm sorry, I didn't see it yet, but
it hasn't come out yet. It's coming out soon, okay. but we're crazy. We're nuts.
it's so dated in its thinking because look, music always this nice a parallel. It's only like to me, it's like a 7-8 year shift, right? We in music are 8 years ahead of the other guys of in film. I've seen myself on the film industry, is that today you write a hit on your Pro Tools at home, or not even Pro Tools, right? On your Ableton Live, you know, you just did, and something out really cool comes out, and you stay with that. You do not need to sign a deal because you can distribute it into the world and get to an audience. That's the idea. Today, as a musician, we filmmakers still think if I don't sign, I'm a failure.
Yeah, it's the old mentality.
If you sign a distribution deal, it's kiss of death. You're signing away. So much. I mean, we have so many filmmakers. Look, we're on the platform. We have like 20,000 titles right now, and there's so many stories attached to these, and so much hope, and so much bad experience, so much education we have to do because most filmmakers are so burned already. With the first film, I've not had like a great. I don't know any good example.
Every filmmaker, pretty much, and I've said this multiple times, is that by the time you get to distribution, you're exhausted, you're broke, your spirit is broken because you didn't get into Sundance, right? It didn't blow up like Reservoir Dogs or any of these big movies from the 90s. You know, these big independent films that just exploded people's careers. When the reality hits. That's when you get to distribution. And then that's when the predatory distributors show up and go, look, I'll take it. I can't give you any money, but it's going to be a 15-year deal. And we'll cap the expenses at $250,000. So like, and you just like, I signed. And I feel that the scariest part about it is that there's certain companies, which will remain nameless, but there's certain distribution companies who have high profile names. And because of their perceived value and perceived authority in the space. You know, I'm not talking like A24 or Neon. These guys take 5-10 movies. They're like basically they're the Sundance of distributors. I'm talking about these other guys who are putting out 40 movies a month. People will sign with them. They're like, "Oh, I got with this company. Look." But they get no money. They get no money.
We have to get away from this branding thinking. Instead, we have to take control and call this the ownership model. Mm-hmm. I have one good example for you. Werner Herzog, or the Werner Herzog as we pronounce him.
Werner, yes.
Werner, yeah. So look, the first, I don't know, 10 movies he did, including Fitzcarraldo and all these beautiful classics and icons, right? And they're still like, when he has a show here in Santa Monica, The Arrow, there's still 500 super young, hungry filmmakers coming, not like the old guys like me, right? Like that's like, it's a new generation who totally gets it. He owns all these movies. He did this for 80,000 Deutschmark, you know, and people died on his set and planes crashed and war started. But he did it, right? He did this guerrilla filmmaking par excellence into big cinema epic. He owns them. He makes a living with these movies today.
That's amazing.
They're still being, you know, licensed out here and there, a film must be shown, and et cetera, et cetera. All the movies he recently did, let's say last 10, 20 years, here, once he's arrived in Hollywood, he doesn't own. And he tells me also, look, Klaus, I wouldn't be here where I am if I wouldn't have my old catalog. That's the ownership model.
Interesting.
So, and to, I don't know how we, I asked him many times, how did you do this at the time? What did you get?
I mean, that was insane. Like, it's not like he just jumped, you know, grabbed the red or, you know, grabbed the Black Magic camera and went off and shot a movie. And there was, it was film. Yeah. 35.
Crazy.
Like in the jungle, he's lifting the ship over. Like, he's a madman.
So today, so we did, I think, three movies or four together. So he tells me, the only thing difference today would be he would like a hotel close to the set.
he's a madman. And I remember his stories. I heard a story of his where I think it was in his masterclass. I don't remember where I heard it, but it was the story where he forged permits or forged some sort of like paperwork.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was a passport or some sort of papers that the they came over and he's like, oh no, don't hold on, I'll go get them for you. He went back to like his, bathroom somewhere and like grabbed some papers and forged them and brought it back to the police and they said, yeah, sure, okay, it's fine. But he's a madman and I love that about him and his work.
Yeah, it's just no compromise. And so was like, now back to distribution, right? So was his, I think his brother is managing mostly the catalog, but he owns it. They own it. So now we need to not get back to this. We need to really embrace this with today's technology. And it's a completely different A to Z like arc, right? Not story-wise, but now from creation to consumer watching, audience watching it. Look, today the situation is like this. There is unlimited shelf space.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more blockbuster that fits only 40 movies in the first top room. Literally, unlimited. It's hard like cloud space, whatever. Second, distribution cost is nearly zero. Well, how much does it possibly cost to get a video stream to India?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. I mean, So you might think like this is great for independent filmmaking. Now we can actually go for the audience. Here's what really happens is our industry has not changed a bit. We're doing exactly the same thing as we do before. Now distribution industry, deals, contracts, film markets, offline markets. You have to travel to Cannes, where I just was, and to Toronto to make a deal. So with this, I went to Silicon Valley to raise funding, and we got funding in Silicon Valley because it was so hard, say this openly, to raise funds in Hollywood. Because if at all people told me, I have so many contacts here, I thought it would be easy to raise funds. They said, well, most of them said, I know you're right, but I don't want you to be right. I want that.
They want the status quo to stay in check.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to disrupt that. You can't disrupt the dinosaur with the dinosaur. And then in Silicon Valley, look at me like, what are you doing? I don't understand even why that's not. That should be so easy, right? And said,
that should be the way of doing it. Yeah,
yeah.
It's funny when you approach people outside of Hollywood and you show them the system, the actual inner workings of this stuff. Business people will look at it and go, is this legal? Like, how is this? How is this? How does this work? Like, what do you mean there's no escrow account? How is there no fiduciary responsibility for a film aggregator? Like, how is this not a thing?
Right.
And I think honestly, I've talked about it, I opened up an entire platform and wrote it and releasing a new book about this specific idea of being the entrepreneurial filmmaker, owning your own property and creating multiple revenue streams from your movie, as in even the movie itself is not the major revenue stream. There's multiple people out there who've built multi-million dollar companies based off of one film. But that's the mentality. That has to be the change in people, because right now in film schools are taught this crap system. Everywhere you turn, all the experts are telling you, no, you got to make your movie. You got to put Eric Roberts and Tom Sizemore in the movie, or Danny Trejo, and put them in the movie. It's gonna, and you take it to AFM or Cannes, and then you have to keep the budget around $1 million or something like that, or you buy, or you get Nicolas Cage, and then you can spend $3 million on a project because it automatically sells in China. But this old kind of mentality of doing things is what is still being, you know, perpetrated on independent filmmakers. And these younger generation, they have no idea, because they just look at these, you know, whatever, distribution gods or film experts, and they just look at them and go, well, he made 50 movies, or they've released 50 movies. They must know what they're talking about. I don't know what I'm talking about. So I think that's what you and I both are trying to do, is educate as much as humanly possible.
Exactly. And by the way, you can't blame the filmmaker. Like you said, the schools teach that also. It's a very opaque system by these privateers, right? There's no absolute transparency. So what we need to do is also counterweight this with transparent operations and just to simplify it, like the emperor's new clothes, like there's nothing to it.
Right.
So let's get your movie out, but it's ownership. You got to work for it. You got to make sure that you do it for an audience,
mm-hmm.
and you raise an audience, right? You like, who are you talking to? Like, just do this. Come on.
Would you agree that the niche audience is the future for filmmakers?
Like, absolutely.
You can't make a broad spectrum romantic comedy at $50,000 and expect it to do anything.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. Now back to the show.
Exactly. And it's I don't call it niche anymore. I call this vertical. Because niche has this like underdog, like small-ish to it.
Okay.
So here's my bold and cunning theory is this. So before, we had to follow the broadcast model. One product for millions. It had to be out from, you know, one to many. Now, the internet is not even built for that. The internet is built for many to many, many servers, many consumers. If you have a broadcast, it's actually quite difficult to do, like a live broadcast from...
Oh, no, like the Olympics or something like that. Exactly. It's like it's hard.
It's hard, you know, and they have to distribute the technology, so it's actually not one to many. So now let's think about this and say, if you are, and it's the same thinking also, if you are now have a narrow but strong community who is your potential audience, you can make now a living and you can make money. You might not make the next Batman revenue, but by the way, it could happen. It's like easy. You make one for 1.5 and you make 60. But there's like this lottery is in there too. But as long as you own it, you don't have to make that much in order to actually be a creator and keep being a creator. And you can find your audience even in the narrow segment. People don't have to tell you anymore, well, you know, your audience too narrow segmented. And you might be surprised you live in this topic. There's in many stories, there's a certain topic or touches certain subjects. And then there's a lot of proximity to outside the movie thinking, to other groups, other communities. We run this technology, we're building this technology based on lots of AI in there, where we create proximities between movies. And even the early tests, beginning of the year, showed us where two movies are similar, which we as humans would have never thought they would actually have some overlap. And that's based on we use actually image recognition and full text search, because we have caption files and etc. So we create like a DNA of a film. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean this movie is good and you like the other one necessarily too, but because it might be not as good. Okay, well, it's hard to say what is a good movie or not. If you tell me one day, if you have a formula for what's a good movie, let me know. I tried over 100 times myself and I can't figure it out.
That's why we have such a crazy business. We're not making a bottle of Coca-Cola. We're not making a soda. We're not like, you can determine. It's just so hard. It's creative. It's art.
It's super hard. And it's super hard because you always have to be, so many reasons, but you have to be so close in detail and attention to detail. And then you have to step back and somebody tells, well, I don't get the story here. Like, oh, shoot. Yeah, there's a story we have to tell too, right? So there's a lot to this. But I think distribution and promotion and everything is like, look, it's your baby, right? So you why would you want to just give it up on birth?
Oh, God, I know. I mean, it makes me cringe because I know you're telling the absolute truth. And it's maddening to me because I've seen filmmakers who've mortgaged their home for $300,000-$400,000. They put this movie together and then they literally hand it over to a stranger. In what business ever does someone spend $400,000 on a product and literally just hand it over to somebody else and hope in good faith that that person will eventually do right by your movie, right by you, and actually pay you and do what they say they're going to do? In what world does that even live?
And now the opportunity, right? So we are in the video streaming, beginning of video streaming age. We do believe a little bit way too much, I think, into Netflix and the three or four majors in America. Well, we'll get to this maybe hopefully you have time, but because there's so much more opportunity. But you do not need to do everything yourself. That doesn't mean you are a good, you have to be a good marketer. You can, for example, work with and hire a la carte the best teams in the world, which by the way do the same for the studios, only for much more, you know, higher fees, which I would charge more of course if Warner Brothers calls you, but you have, because the studios don't know themselves either really, they hire these talent, you know, that's the plus for the studio. So now you can do that too. You can get we're compiling a collaboration, if you want, a partnership list of marketing agencies. These are usually small groups, 2 to 8 people, offices in every part of the world. So you have your team in Australia, you have your team in Pacific Asia. You know, you should look at definitely at Europe. Of course, not forget about, you know, domestic here. But there's so much opportunity now that there's a full access digital world out there. And we need to build and use and embrace the tools. And it is an opportunity. It's not it's not more difficult. It's actually much easier now.
I think the problem, that the systemic problem for this entire conversation we're having for, is that filmmakers don't think about this as part of the creative process. They think that making the product is the beginning and the end of their because that's the sexy part. That's the fun part. That's the fun. No one ever woke up in the morning. Well, I guess a few people, but not many people wake up in the morning going, Facebook ads. Yes. Like don't trust me. I want that person who wakes up and goes, Facebook ads. Yes. You know, or marketing. Yes. You know, I'm a marketer. I have been all my life, but I'm also a filmmaker. So, but most filmmakers think that all I have to, because it's such a moving that rock up the hill to get money to make a movie, to produce a product, to finish it, get it mastered, delivered, and then film festivals if they want to go down that, and then distributors. And then, but that's the old model where at the beginning, if they begin with like, who is this movie for? Who is my audience? How can I reach that audience? What is the budget that this audience will justify? Huge question that needs to be answered, because I could have a niche audience. I always use my vegan chef movie. I always tell people, if you're going to make a romantic comedy, make a romantic comedy about a vegan chef who meets a barbecue champion, and all hell breaks loose, right? And you could target.
Wait, did you make this already?
No, I have a whole in my book. I actually lay out the entire story. I was like, I should make this. But you focus on something like that, and you're like, okay, so the vegans, I'm going to focus on vegans, vegetarians, people who like plant-based. Let's say I'm going to focus on that audience. Is that going to justify a $20 million budget? Probably not. Will that justify a $100,000 budget? Maybe. So you have to figure out how much is that product budget's worth.
I agree. Dude, I worked on $100 million movies, which were – this should have been 25.
Right.
I mean, Harrison Ford and you know, the marketing had to put in shots into the trailer, which weren't even shot for the movie. I mean, this is complete betrayal to the audience just to justify the budgets, you know?
Of course.
crazy, crazy stuff. So no, of course, and you don't need this. I work, for example, with every type of budget. I did movies for virtually unlimited, and I did projects with $1 or something. Yeah. Actually, literally $1, and I paid 10 cents to my agent.
Of course. And did you go in and hand it cash, or did you write a check? I think a check, and then send it to him by mail and put the stamp on it that costs 32 cents.
That is how our industry works. That sums up the efficiency of what we do.
It's basically an episode of Seinfeld.
Yeah, that's for every situation in life. There's an episode of Seinfeld here. But so, like, look, and now to the practicalities of this. Distributor is not the only distribution company going out of business. Unfortunately, it was probably the hope of many new filmmakers and like the hope of like, oh, things could do differently. But they didn't do it too differently, I would think. Anyway, so what you can do is, I'm not a legal expert. I'm sure you have probably much better sources for this. What we have been doing in these cases is we help with filing complaints to the channels, because usually what happens is dead, right? There's nothing happening. I had actually movies in production and pre-production stuck in these kind of situations. So suddenly you lose your cast. Mm-hmm. Because you can't move it forward. So here at least there's a bit better hope. So we can help with filing complaints to these. These are more or less like copyright notices.
Just to be clarified, these are from people who are dealing with distributor that their movies are still locked up on this on the platforms through distributors, and then they can't get the movies down because distributor either can't or won't release the films or pull those things down. So now the filmmakers lost their movie, lost their money, and can't access their film anymore. So now this is what you're talking about helping.
Yes, exactly. That's the situation for many now, and I'm sure they're desperate. And many have not been paid or not been paid for a long time. So again, not to give legal advice, which I'm so the wrong person, but in general, how it works. So your distribution company is in breach of the contract because they didn't pay you, or they didn't pay you in time, etc. So what we can then help you with is, because we've done it so many times, we have relationships there, we go to the channels and file a certain document so that there's a takedown notice. If then that puts the ball into distributor court again, meaning if they don't respond, which they probably don't because they can't.
They have the time, yeah.
You actually have it signed over to you, so we can either take it down or we can sign it. No, they can get it back.
So let's say it's on Amazon, in this you go through this process of filing the copyright claim. If you will they take it down, or will they just switch the rights? So meaning that all the reviews and things stay up there.
99.9% they take it down, and you have to get it back up on your own.
And do you lose your reviews and all that?
Exactly. That's the big problem. But we were, not to pride ourselves, but we were able, especially with Amazon, because we have thousands of movies up there, to like talk to them, which even though for us it's hard to talk to Amazon. And some we were able to shift over. That also means that the revenue stream, which was accumulated at the, you know, for a while, could be switched over to, and it would be from day, and you would get the revenue from day one again. If they didn't pay out yet, Amazon, for example, as far as I know, I'm not into operation, it does pay by automatic payment. So it, mm-hmm. meaning if it's not a check, which could be stale, unfortunately, meaning,
right now the movies that are up through distributor, the movies are still up there. People are still renting, still buying, and still streaming it on SVOD. That money is arguably still going to distributor.
Right. So that you have about 3 months now to freeze it. So you have to act quickly that the money, which is rather have Amazon accumulate than paying out distributor, right? Mm-hmm. At this point, I would say. Now, I'm not aware if distributor really filed.
They have not filed. They have not filed bankruptcy. They hired a firm that is they're reorganizing specialists. But if you look deeper, they're a bankruptcy company to reorganize the company, stop the bleeding, set things up, and then pretty much prepare it for either bankruptcy or they'll try to go find money to reinvest. Who's going to spend money on that? That brand is pretty much dead at this point. So no one's going to infuse any cash into this business because the model is ridiculous. And there was gross mismanagement and all of this kind of stuff with the money. So there's no signs, at least from my point of view and from the people, my little birdies in the business who talk to me on the side, there's no hope that I see that this is going to come – they're going to come out of this. Like there's Go Digital, Distribute, any of these guys, the companies, they're not going to be able to come back out and start business as usual. It just – it's not going to work.
Then I'm not the legal expert. Then I would recommend very, very quickly before they file –
yes.
File your complaint, because once they file for bankruptcy, it's protected and it's much harder for you to get at the assets. Mm. And then it might be stuck in that.
So let me ask you a question. How is that considered an asset? Because it's not, they're just a service. They're, like you said, you're hiring them for a service. So it's not a distribution company per se. They are an aggregator. So that means that they're just did my job. So arguably the films that they've put up, they're not their assets. They're just things.
That's right. They don't have the rights to them, but they're still considered like an asset because just by having access to it and the money flows through them. And also I understand in the fine print of these aggregators, they always say like you get 100% and you only pay up front only. But also that's not true. There's always a yearly fee you have to pay for your movies for other reasons. They call the money differently.
I saw the article by Stephen Follows who actually broke down everything from Distributor. And there was I joined them years ago, so I didn't do any of this. I was grandfathered in. But currently, it's like you had to spend $20 to get a check.
Yeah, exactly.
To get paid, right, you needed to spend $20. Like,
pay to get paid. Nice, huh? Right.
It was like, what scam is this? And then on top of that, $200 a year, keep it up on the platform fee. And you could just tell that they were just the water was just coming and coming. Oh God. Yeah, it's so brutal. But I wanna ask you this because you mentioned a couple things in regards to the money flowing through them. I mentioned this in one of my live broadcasts in regards to this problem, that unlike a distributor has you have choices of thousands of distributors. And if you decide to go into business with a distributor and they screw you over or do whatever they're going to do, that's on you because you had multiple choices around the world that you could have gone with. But with aggregators, there's arguably five that all the platforms force you to use. And it's not just us. The major studios are forced to go through them as well. So on a liability standpoint, I know we're not attorneys, but on a liability standpoint, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, iTunes, Apple, they have to have some sort of responsibility because they force people to go through. Like if you get a Netflix deal, I could call up Netflix right now and Netflix is like, I want to buy your movie for $500,000. I'm like, great. Okay, how do I send it to you? You have to go through one of these companies. And this is the company that we want you to go through. And oh, by the way, we're going to send our check to that company and that company is then going to pay you. So you see how ludicrous this situation is. So I feel that there is some sort of liability towards the platforms. Would you agree, disagree?
That's true because after all, you had to use them. That's an interesting thought. iTunes was the first one to actually be there, right? And by the way, we don't feel that they are of any significance anymore for quite a while, right?
I mean, they haven't been.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We feel this too. We see it in our data, but so they have. The only ones who are really officially putting this on the website is there's these encoding houses and these aggregators, they call them. Even the aggregators have to use the encoding houses because you have to go through an aggregator or an encoding because these are the only ones who have a business relationship with Apple, the encoding houses. So even less there's a value for these what these aggregators provide. So this is honestly understood this. This is also like, where's the emperor's new clothes here? Why do you have to do that? I understand that Apple cannot deal with thousands of content providers. Mm-hmm. And something like this makes sense also to let's say normalize the technical quality. That makes sense in a way. But from business standpoint, this goes back to like, okay, Netflix, because you mentioned it. I want to say this too, is while at the beginning when Netflix was the first one to come out with like, here's a new way of like streaming to consumers, their development to me is, it was a big hope for independent film, right? Now we have a direct outlet for our stuff we create. Unfortunately, you might have noticed, many might not have noticed it, is the exact opposite. It turned into another HBO, or they want to be another Warner Brothers. They want to create a studio which they completely control. 52% of last year was already like their own production. If you are in the business of getting a co-production deal, which is also a kiss of death to me, like you get what you get. They don't give you any data. It's much worse than Warner Brothers or Sony.
They get no back end or very rare, nothing.
Right. But it's not that you make a movie and then you go to Netflix and they license it. I mean, there's less and less. The chances are they don't even want that anymore. It's a very, very different, and still it's a very old studio like business model, which is the opposite of the hope for independent filmmakers. It's actually now less hope. It's even less for filmmakers now open what to do, because now the studios do less movies. Before they did 200 in this town. Now they do like what, 12 a year, right?
So there's, yeah, but instead of 200 that cost 20 million, 25 million with the occasional $100 million movie, now they do 12 that cost $200 million each, because right, they're not in the business of making a $25 million to make $200 million. They're in the business of making $200 million to make a billion.
Right, exactly. And that's now, insane. At the same time, we, with digital production pipelines and, you know, production qualities we can do today with very little investment, I'm here saying with a good idea and good execution, you can do any movie now. Mm-hmm. And it looks like $1 million. No, it looks like $100 million. No, it looks like solid production value. It doesn't look like a video. It looks really like something where people would be fooled to believing this was done by, you know, the old brands.
Professionals.
Which we are, right? I mean,
yes,
so
exactly.
Just good talent. And again, digital production used right, fantastic opportunity. Now, so there's more and more content being produced. I call this, sorry, content as a businessman here, but you know, movies, shows, we have these, what we look down on in our industry, these YouTubers who create content which is 100 billion times being viewed. This is the new TV shows of today, right? This is cool stuff. I mean, there's some crap
with
stuff.
With no cost, with barely any cost. I've said this a bunch of times that an hour is an hour, regardless if that hour costs $100 million or is just me talking. It's an hour of attention. And the more eyeballs you can get on that hour, it doesn't really matter if it costs $100 million or if it's just Tony Robbins talking to you for an hour about self-help. It doesn't matter. And so, that's what scares the hell out of the industry, I think.
Exactly. So they don't know. Nobody's taking care of these, what, you know, these, I call them, well, some call them the digital first creators. They're jailed to YouTube at this point. That shouldn't be the case either. YouTube pays like SH, you know, like, it's just nothing. You need Patreon and others to actually make a living out of YouTube. How ridiculous is that? So this has to all change. And this is exactly what I stand for, is like to find ways with technology to, like, guys, we got to change our way of looking at things. And again, this is not, look, it's not, as you hopefully now feel, it's not advertisement for Film Hub or anything, but it's my, I despise how this old system works. And not only that, I want to
disrupt it.
I want to create it's my legacy. Like, yes, I've done a few movies, but this is, I can almost no longer do one movie at a time. I want to now help thousands and hundreds of thousands. And
I feel you.
Yeah, right. I mean, you do your too, right? You're doing your own stuff creatively, but you see the problems everyone has. And yeah, like you, you don't sit still. You actually help, and that's exactly what I'm doing, Tom.
Yeah, I agree, and it's and personally, I find it addictive to be of service to a community or to be of service to people because it on a selfish standpoint, it just feels really good to be able to help. Like I literally talked to a filmmaker yesterday, and they had their plan set up to like, oh, we're going to go the festival route, and we're going to do this and this, and we submit it to all the big festivals. And I looked at the movie, and I said, no. No, this is not a movie for the festivals. It's just not. You're playing the lottery ticket again. You should focus on distribution. You have a marketable product. You have a good thing. Boom, boom, boom. And I laid out this entire – and you saw his eyes just like, oh, my God, thank you so much. Like, you would have wasted a year. And I also told him, like, and let's say you get into one of these film festivals. For your kind of movie, which is kind of like basically a comedy, romantic comedy, something like that. How much does a Sundance Laurel really mean? Bottom line, like on how much money, extra money are you going to get for that?
Exactly. I was in Cannes this year, listened a lot to the panel talks with this new idea like that you can, we know it's now different. Listen to distribution panels. Went in there, talked to the guys, and there's seriously people still doing exactly this. Well, here's how you get your movie. What do you do? Okay. And I asked them, so don't call us, don't email me. But here's how you write the emails, but don't email me, right? We do 8 movies a year. I'm talking of short films, right? Yeah, in that case. So it was short film. And I asked them, so do you engage in marketing? Well, usually we don't. But so what's the exploitation strategy with these? Well, we put them on the festival run. Well, I can't do this myself. Doesn't festival mean paying money instead of making money? Where's the revenue? So there is absolutely no idea, including the top distributors who are on these markets, on these film festivals, how to actually generate revenue for you.
Right. Film festivals are cultural events. You know, they're not. Jonathan Wolf, the guy who runs AFM, said that very clearly. It's like, a market is a business. Like, they're about money. And film festivals are cultural events. They have nothing to do with business, at least for the filmmaker. On their side, it's all about the business. But in the front, for the filmmakers, means nothing. How about is it if you get into a festival and you fill the audience with the 3-4 showings of like 200-300 people each, you get nothing. Just the pleasure of being there.
Exactly. I can say on many of these events with movies which made it to Sundance and stuff that I was actually sitting there in front of the audience or at dinners and events, and I felt bad that we're spending this kind of money.
Right.
Of what? That's just to, for yourself.
It's an ego trip. It's an ego trip.
And if you – I felt really – this is, again, it's very parallel to these – we have music publishers, so-called publishers, where they'll wine and dine, and when the band is playing in the club, and no one involved on the dining table can do anything for the band, but the band is paying for that. Is the same situation we have in movies still. So maybe it's just we need education for producers and for creators to tell them, do you really want this? Look at this with fresh new eyes. There's alternatives, and I am building alternatives to this, not only advice, but really alternatives how we can change this.
Do you think that this downfall of Distributor is a sign of like are they the Lehman Brothers of the distribution business? Can they be on a much smaller, obviously much smaller scale? are they the crack in the armor that not only for film aggregate, I think for film aggregators is specifically the question, but generally in distribution, because I do feel that nobody knows what's going on. Nobody really knows how to make real money in the distribution game anymore because things change weekly now. So do you think it's a sign?
It's a bit like the dot-com bubble in –
correct.
What was it, 2000-something?
Right? 99,
right? So this the first time everybody thought it's just a hype and there's really no value. And that was the first .com. And after that, there's real value being created. And I think this is the phase we're in, well, almost in right now. We're a bit early, right? It's still like we have, you know, from the hearsay, we have to do something. We have to have a digital strategy, but nobody knows what that really means. Also, I have to admit that there's, how can you? Because all these channels which are coming out now, I mean, we're looking at 3,000 something channels right now. Many of them, channels, I mean, video streaming platforms.
Niches, yeah, niche markets.
Right. Some are actually mainstream. For example, one of our amazing users is Tubi TV. I don't know if you're aware of it.
Of course.
Tubi TV has one of the highest per title rates available. What do they do? Advertisement based. Ooh, isn't that bad? No, it's how networks used to work. Still do.
And I've been telling that. I've been preaching it from the top of the mountain. I'm like, guys, the money is not in TVOD. TVOD is dead. It is going to be AVOD and some SVOD. But AVOD is the growth part of this model now,
right?
Without question.
And I like that you're saying this and you're seeing this. And I even go further and say, well, you know what? I don't even know where it's going to be. There might be a combination because it's hybrid, so early. Yeah. That's what I meant. It's so early because TVOD was just, what, 2 years ago? Everything was TVOD.
Right. People were like, making – I mean, I've had people on the show that have made millions of dollars on TVOD, but that was 3 years ago.
Right.
And they also had massive audiences and they knew what they were doing and it was a whole thing.
And this is now my plea is also we need to create a sustainable model. If you think if you make your movie as I don't know, let's say you make it for $5 million, that's a big deal, right? And you sell it for $7 million to Amazon, you know, studios, not Amazon Prime, but Amazon Studios. Do you really think this is a sustainable model? Don't you think like, well, somebody's got to pay for it at the end if you deliver a shit film? They won't make $7 million. So somebody's got to pay for it at the end of the day. So now, if you believe you have a hit or a solid product in your hand, why would you give it away and say, well, I'd rather take like something and I'm out? Then shouldn't you own it and have it for long term and build your actually wealth?
Portfolio
too, but also like a revenue stream instead of. So either you don't believe in it, then you shouldn't be selling it overpriced because that's not sustainable. If you do believe in it, you shouldn't sell it either because, you know, you should participate and have a portfolio and have a catalog. So this whole system of like, look, I sold my movie for $2 million more than I made it, unless it makes its money, it's just you contributing to the death of our industry.
Wow, that's amazing statement. I love that statement. It's absolutely true. There is no model right now laid out, generally speaking, as a sustainable model. You know, I'm putting out the thesis of being a filmtrepreneur, which is being an entrepreneurial filmmaker, which is creating multiple revenue streams from your movies and doing it not once, but multiple times where you can create a portfolio which has a ton of, and all of a sudden after 2-3 years of doing something like that, all of a sudden you've got enough money to pay the mortgage, to do what you love to do.
Right.
I mean, it's the bottom line, and I want everyone listening right now and watching this right now, I want you to understand this. The dream of being a filmmaker or being a creator is not to be a multimillionaire living up in the Hollywood Hills. That's fantastic. I would love to walk down the path that Robert Rodriguez did or Kevin Smith did or any of these, you know, icons of the 90s independent film movement. But isn't the goal to be sustainable, to have food on your plate, food on the table, a roof over your head, and to do what you love to do for a living? Isn't that the dream? It doesn't matter what the scale is.
Exactly. And there's only an upside to this. And you can say, honestly, you never ripped off someone. Because if your goal is not to be ripped off by ripping off, I mean, that's just, then you're part of it. Don't complain then. Go back. You know, repeat. But if you want to, right. And now is the opportunity. Also, like part of this, as you say, is the, it's the multi-track distribution strategy. Is you said very rightly, it's like the 360 idea of like, there's all kinds of revenue streams. I'm doing the same thing. I'm educating so much about, look, there is a world outside Amazon, Hulu, and Netflix. And it's a grand world, and that's your opportunity world. These are actually not your opportunity. It's a system which is not built for you. the system which is built for you is the one we're building right now. Everyone is building right now, not only Film Hub, but is the system of where are the eyeballs? Go for the eyeballs. I mean, by the way, there was a time, and it still is the case, where production companies thought they could create their own channels. Not even Warner was able to do this, right? That's not where the eyeballs are. Netflix had the eyeballs because of the DVD business. Amazon sneaked in the Prime business by promising you free shipping. I mean, come on. Hulu was owned by a TV company, so they did the reruns. So the eyeballs were there. You're right.
But now Apple, Disney Plus I'm interested in. But they also have a lot of content.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Right. You cannot watch them. They just pull the movies under your, like a rug on your feet always and put it back on the market. And for 10 years, you cannot watch that.
But that's gone now. They're stopping that model with Disney Plus. They're putting up their classics. Yeah, that whole model it's gone.
They're dead, right? Yeah. I was so angry always.
Oh, I know. It was always smart because back in the day when I was still hustling hard in the DVD market, when one of those would hit, I would buy 20 of them. I would literally stack them. Yeah. I would put them in a closet and wait about a year and a half or 2 years after they release. And then I would just put them up on eBay. So I would easily double, if not sometimes triple my money on it. And it was just a nice little extra side hustle that I had going on.
I love that idea.
I did it with VHSs too. I started when I was in the video store doing VHSs.
Sorry that the business model is now invalidated by Disney Plus. But Disney Plus, for example, it's still their own catalog. Yeah, I mean, Disney has been great in acquiring other brands, right?
Yes.
And very cool how they expanded. But to me, this means and we have enough data about this, not everyone wants to watch the same big shoot all over all the time. There is 72% last year of all subscribers of the big subscription services said 72% said there's not enough variety. They want to see more variety of movies and shows. And that's what you call niche or vertical or just there's various interests. And it's no longer the case that we do not have to cater to the masses only. It's a bit of this long tail theory. You might be familiar. It's this
very much
curve. There's a lot under the lower end of the curve, and only like the I call this not even top 1%, but like on the left side the percent. Mm-hmm. What it likes to call premium content, I call everything premium content. Everything is premium. If you just reach an audience of 60,000, you have a premium content. If you are able to monetize it.
Yeah, so it basically premium, and I use this example all the time, and I say to the filmmakers, if the only thing that's going to be able to break through all this noise is going to be niche programming, which is, let's say, are you a surfer? If you're a surfer and there's a movie about a surfer up there, it will cut through all the noise because this really interests me. If I'm a skateboarder, if I'm a vegan, if I'm a filmmaker and I want to watch a movie about filmmakers at Sundance, which is my movie, then that's a movie that will cut through all of the other noise because it really talks to me as opposed to Avengers, which is great and it's fun and I loved it. But, there's only so many of those out there. And at a certain point, you got to cut through.
Right. And there's a certain fatigue in the audience too because they now know there's more stuff and it's been withheld from them. Because I've heard about that. I've got all these, online communities in general, like Facebook groups and stuff. Here's my top 20 list of horror movies last week. And then there's these notes, no longer on Netflix. Well, you can get it there. And then there's a link of like an illegal download because it's no longer available, right? This is the bullshit we've been doing, withholding content from the audience who actually knows much better now.
Yeah,
and that's just the beginning of it. There's no big billboards needed on Santa Monica Boulevard. It does work for a certain type, and I'm not saying what the studios are doing is wrong. There is an audience for this too, fantastic, but it's no longer the only way.
But it's a different business model, and that's another thing that we as independent filmmakers so often we're trying to follow the model set by the studios, which you can't do. You can't make a romantic comedy with no stars in it and expect anybody to show up because you don't have the market. Like the studios can make a romantic comedy with maybe an unknown and put it out there because they have $100 million that they're going to pump into the marketing. So right. everybody knows about it, whether it makes right. money or not, you know, irrelevant at this point of the day.
Right.
I wanted to ask you really quickly a couple questions in regards to traditional distribution. What advice do you have for filmmakers dealing with traditional distributors? Because I do think there are places for traditional distribution and distribution companies if they're the right partner and if it matches or is aligned with the goals of your film. You know, like, you know, you and I both have film, you know, we're both friends with Linda and Michael from Indie Rights, which is quote unquote a traditional distributor, but I don't really consider them a traditional distributor.
Yeah. Right.
But there are certain distributors that are out there that actually do, that are honest, that are straightforward, that really care about the film. They're rare, and I do know a handful of them, but there are not many of them out there. So what's your advice?
Yeah, no, they're more like consultants, or I would call them like the package distribution. So they help you create the full-on package. And that service is, there's definitely a value. That's why what we're building with FilmWeb is this machine where they can use that too. And actually, indeed, Linda does. You know, they're using this to get your stuff out in the world. But there's certainly added value to get a marketing package or get a promotion, get a social media package going. You can't just put it up there and hope for the best. I mean, then you know, might as well not do it. But that's what these great companies do. It's a bit like a good music supervisor, you know, who listens to new music. There's others who just... Or agents, best idea. There's agents who look out for you, and there's most of them don't. They just call you and say, "Hi, what did you do last week? What can I charge you?" This is exactly the same. So, a general advice of how to watch out that they, if you have the right partner, is hard to say.
So in regards to the right partner, let's say you're going into business with the wrong partner. Let's say we're gonna go into a predatory deal because you're exhausted, you have no other outsource, you've spent $300,000 of your mom's retirement account on this black and white movie that has no stars in it, and you know, and you got one predatory distributor that says, you know what, here's the deal. What are those points that, and I can go off, but I want to hear what yours are as well, but what are a few of those points that you should go, this is a red flag, you'd be better off just going through, you know, a company like Indie Rights or a company like yours and doing the self-distribution model? At least you own it, whether you'll be able to make that $300,000, that you've made mistakes way beyond before you got to this point. Or do you want to just, I always call it a non-tax deductible donation to these companies. That's what it is. It's a non-tax deductible donation to the company, basically to the distributor.
Yes, you're so right. And unfortunately, it's so very little value. But so if you go through the contract, a regular distribution contract, a standard distribution contract, there is not a single thing in there which I would recommend doing. So you're asking the wrong guy. I'm sorry.
There's nothing. Just nothing. There's no. Nothing.
Everything in there is, if they tell you something, it's probably the opposite of what they write in there, is that you lose control about spending, you lose control about what to do with your title, with your movie. I don't want to make Linda look bad. You know what I mean? Like, there are values, but usually it's, if you go through contract, like, how would you prevent this from happening? It's very hard because these contracts are... You know, they tell you all that everybody signs it. That's already a red flag. That you have to pay anything is a red flag. I think it's all about transparency. These companies today have to account to you on a monthly basis, not on a yearly or a 6-month basis. And I would absolutely ask for approval rights, which you probably won't get. I work with like top directors. Like, there's only like what? A handful of directors have final cut in this town.
Oh, yeah.
Very few. So, right. But no one of these guys makes use of it. So if you have a distributor that's turning around who says, well, we have the right, and you don't have the right to approve it. But if they give you in practice the opportunity to say no or to work with you on it. Now, then that's great. But the only thing is, how would you know this up front? So now I actually want to hear from you. What do you think is a good feature set to look out for?
I mean, I could talk to you about warnings that I've experienced. The concept of cross collateration, which is a longer conversation, and we can talk about that later. It's a deep ridiculousness. Well, all right, just so everybody, because everyone's going to go, Alex, what is cross collateration? I can't say the damn word. Cross collateration, whatever that word is when they basically have, there's two ways of doing it, but I'll talk about the first one. Is you have one movie, and say your movie, you go to a buyer, and that buyer wants to buy that movie for $10,000, in the territory of Germany, for let's say, and then the distributor goes, oh wait a minute, I'm going to package 9 other movies in with this movie. You still only have to pay me $10,000, but I'm going to throw in 9 other movies for you. So now you would have gotten whatever, 70%, 60%, 80%, whatever of that $10,000. But now you get it of $1,000. And that is cross collateration. And they do the same thing with expenses as well.
There they charge like 10 times, not like.
Oh, no. Day. Yeah. 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 If you spend money on DVDs, let's say you spend $5,000 on DVDs and they don't sell, and it still costs you $5,000, and then you make $5,000 off of a streaming deal, they'll throw it all in the pot and you got zero. As opposed to like, I didn't approve that $5,000 you spent. Oh, but you made $5,000 over here. So I'm not going to take a hit. I'm the distributor. So why should I take a hit? There's that. There's length of agreement, which is, I literally saw this with a filmmaker who's probably watching this, and I won't say the name of the movie, but it was a deal from one of these big reputable companies who have a nice logo. And the deal was 15 years. And it was $100,000 or $150,000 marketing cap. 15 years. And I told him, he's like, Alex, I think I know what you're going to tell me. I'm like, yeah, run the hell away. Length of agreement. There's so many different things. So, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't even know if there are. I don't know of any contracts which are vastly different.
Linda in Indie Rights is probably the only one of the few companies out there that does like, you know, a 3-year deal. And they're completely transparent with all their filmmakers. So there's no hiding behind anything. They're really upfront with you. They tell you exactly what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. And that's basically that's one of the reasons why I went with them for my films, because they also make sense for my budget, my budget range and things like that. So it's probably one of the best deals in town. She's a unicorn. There's no question about it. Indie Rides is a unicorn. There are not many of them flying around. You are a unicorn. That's not many of you flying around. So they're just different models, different opportunities. But is there a place for them? Possibly. Because I've also heard of filmmakers who have signed those deals that maybe it was like a 5-year or 7-year deal, and they got a Showtime deal out of it. They got a Redbox deal out of it. You know, they got a family video deal out of it, where they're like still selling DVDs to Family Video, which is the only living video store chain left in the middle of the country somewhere. but they go out and they make these you can't do that on a self-distribution model. You can't do that, you know, doing those kind of, it's more difficult, if not impossible. So are there potentials? Yes, but I do believe that they are outliers. They are not the usual. They're just like, oh, by the way, we submitted it to Redbox and Redbox kind of liked what you had, so they're going to give you a 2000 DVD order.
Yeah, these are all dying models anyway. That's a problem, right?
Agreed. I don't think everything I just laid out are you're grasping to the final bit of money that's flying around. And I also wanted to say, right now we're in arguably a good economic environment. As soon as the next bubble bursts or the next downturn comes, which you know it's coming any day now. It's going to happen within the next year, if not shorter, year or two. We're way overdue. Something's going to happen, and I think it's going to be probably worse than 2008. Mm. And if that does – I'm not being a conspiracy, but it's just like it's just history. I mean, we see it. how do you think our industry is going to survive? Like it barely took the hit of 2008. I remember 2008, and it was just like people were just – companies were folding. Movies were being lost. It was just – and we're having trouble in a good situation as economically. Can you imagine once the pressure of the world comes crashing down on our little business?
Yeah, but I totally agree. But I see this as an opportunity again, because I think who get hit the most – are those old industry types. Because these deals and dealing, deal making, and
they're fat.
Oh my gosh.
They're fat.
That's, yeah, because there's a high margin in for all these guys, just not the creator and not the consumer. right? I mean, that's where it gets skimmed off. It's crazy. But that means that you, with your low budget, medium budget, you financed it in an alternative way. Look, I talked to high-profile producers, including New York. They tell me in the last 3 years they haven't done a traditional financing on any movie. It's been all Netflix and Amazon. That is, to me, super red alert. This is like the highest dependency ever. I personally now, okay, well, we're on air or something, but I see the bubble also with Netflix. I see this as a high dependency, which is at high risk. Thy financing is not secure. Their model to me is high risk.
They have a lot of debt. They have a tremendous amount of debt. Tremendous amount of debt.
Yeah. And all they do is that the difference is they don't sell tickets, but subscriptions, but that can, you know, change as the tickets can change. So and then you have nothing left as a you know, producer. I've worked with so many even high profile producers. I'm not saying $100 million movies, but like solid movies, $20 million movies. They haven't, after the initial deal, they didn't see any money. They get a short time deal, yeah, but that's, they're supposed to represent it, and there's no money for them anymore. Nothing gets reported, is late. It's, you know, of the infamous Harry Potter Warner Brothers.
I didn't hear that one.
Oh, I'll send. You can repost it. The report that there's no profit.
On which Harry Potter? On all of them? No.
No. I'll send you this thing which went around. This is a copy of a profit report, of a royalty report, where the whoever recipient was saw nothing, because it was all and the revenue was, what we're talking of, like $500 million something. So there's all kinds of interesting accounting ways. So
it was like Forrest Gump. Remember Forrest Gump? They came out publicly and said, "Oh no, Forrest Gump, we're still in the red on Forrest Gump." And then like it made $683 million. Are you that incompetent? Yeah. Are you that incompetent of a company that you cannot make a profit on a movie that cost you X dollars? And like,
yeah. And again, I compare this always to the music industry, who we see is ahead of us, and we can see what the solutions are. When you had a platinum record, you would be still paying your record company, owing your record company. Mm-hmm. But if you sell 60,000 records or 30,000 on your own, touring all the time, you can make a fantastic living. You actually make more than, you know,
T-shirts. Don't forget T-shirts, hats, photo opportunities. Okay. Yeah, the bands are starting to sell photo ops in the back. So to go backstage, you'll charge you $150. You can come back. We'll take a picture. We'll talk for a second.
That's great. I love it.
Why love not? It. It's another revenue stream, you know?
So we have to come up with more revenue streams for filmmakers too. Musicians have this live channel, right? So now, but what for example, FilmUp does is we say, and there's a lot of education about this too, you have to go as many multi-channel strategy. Look, last year, if you bank on Amazon, I do Amazon my own, and I don't trust any other guys. Do you get a payment rate hit of 74%, and you don't even know how much they pay? Now they're taking all these titles offline, and they don't tell you why and which ones and why they did this. There's no way. This is like it's a complete it's an authoritarian state of video streaming and film streaming. So you must not rely on a handful or even less of these domestic channels. You have to go super wide.
And would you agree? I don't mean to interrupt you, but do you agree that you need to look at your film as an investment in a portfolio? You can't invest in one stock. You need to have a diverse stock. You have to have diverse revenue streams coming in. And if it's $5 here, $10 there, $100 here, $2,000 there, every month that those revenue streams come up. Because if one goes down, you've got other revenue streams that could pick up and cover it. But if you put all your eggs in that one basket, this is what they do. And it's like doing that with a traditional distributor sometimes. It cannot be a good thing, especially the predatory ones. Like, you're putting everything in this one. This is the only channel. The only way I can make money with my movie is the old way, which is BS.
No, it's BS and dangerous. These Very. Things is actually dangerous and high. It's high risk suddenly to a product you have. So we need to go wide. And I mean, and then the most obscure things often happen. We had this thing where suddenly China ordered hundreds of independent Indian films, like Bollywood, you would call it, but they're not Bollywood, really. Suddenly this worked. Well, who knows? And this multilateral, flow, pun intended, for streaming, right? And today it's getting much, much easier, for example, to get English material out. I mean, you might not even need captions when captions are needed by some channels, but technically, you have a good chance of having your English language title out in many countries of the world. As like 10 years or 5 years ago, it was harder. They wanted like their local only and harder to get in. And then you had distributors telling you, well, it's not, the demand is not big enough to get in there, blah, blah, blah. But there's no more big enough these days. That doesn't count anymore.
Look, Brad Pitt just got beat at the box office by Downton Abbey. I'm just throwing that out there, okay? Like, Brad Pitt, arguably one of the biggest movie stars in the world, got beaten by a niche film that is niche. I'm not going to watch Downton Abbey. That's not my crowd. I don't want to watch that. But to its audience, they came out with a gangbusters. And not any of those stars in that movie could open any movie ever. But in Downton Abbey, they could.
Yeah, exactly, right? Isn't it beautiful? It's a great story, I think.
Yeah, it is.
And it started out as, okay, it was a relatively high budget TV show, but still, you know, it's coming out of nowhere, really.
Right. I mean, you're talking about a space, like a $100 million+ Brad Pitt vehicle. Like, I mean, your chances of, and then it's like, oh, it's also about that drama about, a British drama. It's a BBC, BBC. Episode out there, an hour and a half episode that's beating Brad Pitt, $100 million.
It's a beautiful world. And we had this. Look, I have, like I said, we have so many titles on the platform. So many that I cannot watch them anymore. All of them, definitely. I look in there, and some of them, I have to admit, look, we don't curate, right? So what I say is, it's a principal and major feature is, there's no one can tell you if a movie is good or will make money. That's different too, by the way, right? Very different. So who am I to say that, even though our industry is full of these people who you know, on markets that tell you, have you heard? No, I don't know. I haven't. Nobody told me yet that it's good. I have to hear from others too, first. And all this BS. So we have all these titles, and some of them I thought, oh my God, that's not good. That's really, embarrassing. Okay, well, we get all that too. Okay, well, since we don't curate, we get everything, right? So this, but the system works differently with a platform like this. So, and there were titles in there which made the first weekend so much money when they came out on Amazon and all these streaming services. Where, like, I would have never thought myself. And I pride myself in, like, knowing a little bit about the movie industry, but who am I to say? Nobody knows anything. I worked on Brad Pitt movies, which completely tanked. I worked with directors who did the Brad Pitt movie before mine, which completely tanked. He worked with me, and it was a big hit. So you never know. You never know. You cannot. Nothing is 100% or even 90%. And that's why, on the positive side, as an independent filmmaker, you know, Downton Abbey is not that indie, right?
No.
But still, it's the direction where it comes from.
Compared to a Brad Pitt vehicle, it's pretty indie, but it's not indie. I know what you mean.
And there is lots of butter out there for your bread. That's the point. And
good quote. I like that.
Get that. Get a little bit off that, and get it in chunks, little chunks, and
Now, really quickly, I want to give you an opportunity to talk specifically about Film Hub, because you've been so gracious with your time talking about the business in general. I do want to give a little bit of time to just please tell everybody the business model and what you do at Film Hub.
So you might have now heard through this grapevine like this. I don't believe in the old system of distribution and aggregation. So what I build Film Hub out is, it's not an aggregator. I can tell you what it's not. It's not an aggregator. It's not a distribution company. It is a platform, or a, in Silicon Valley, they call it a marketplace. It's more like Airbnb than A24. So it's what you do is, you have a movie or you have a show, you upload it, and you're one of the users. There's no cost involved whatsoever for you. You enter, you know, it's very professionally done. I hope you guys agree. We upload all the data you usually would give as a deliverable to a distribution company. And then on the other side, we have these buyers. We have of hundreds of channels, video streaming platforms, buyers who these titles get marketed to. So they can browse the catalog in the traditional way, but they're also, we're using more and more AI tools and deep learning tools to match what they like. So
these are buyers.
These are buyers, exactly. So then they order the titles from the platform, and it's also free for them as well. Then the whole deliverable process of, like, you know, what you get charged for a distributor, etc. This is all included. You know, you don't have to pay anything, because we put this into the cloud, and it costs us almost nothing. It's just development. So we take the whole distribution process online. And then when someone watches it on, let's say, I don't know, China Mobile, because they bought your title. In this case, license means, usually 99% means, they get the title for free. You have a performance model. When someone is watching him, or you get a share of the subscription fees, they come through us. We also consolidated a nice looking dashboard, so you can see what country your revenue is coming from, etc. And then with our latest update, you can actually withdraw it. So far, we've been still like paying quarterly.
Do you only do features, or do shorts as well?
Shorts. We have a lot of shorts. We even have some special deals with some cable channels sometimes who put out like short festivals on. I mean, cable festivals. Short form. Facebook Watch is still not out. What's actually that going to be? But it's all about short form. I think short form is the future, by the way. There's so much short form demand.
Interesting.
Because that's how users behave. You know. I mean, my 18-year-old daughter cannot listen to a song for more than a minute. So, you know what I mean? Like, they used to be 8 minutes long when we had vinyl albums. Jeez. And now...
I mean, like Queen alone.
Yeah. There you go. And it's a big hit in the theaters too. So, look, yeah. I mean, there's still demand for this, but like, skip after a minute. So the attention span is very low. So short form is actually great. I'm not promising you will be a millionaire with this, but it's a very fair system where you get what comes in. We take a small share. We take 20% of what comes in at this point. We're still thinking about the business model, how to adjust it, but that's just to keep the lights on.
But there's no cost up front.
There's no cost, no. And it's only found money. So you have a movie, there's nothing to lose. And you can take it off you just put a notice in for us, you want to take it off, or you can even say, hey, I made a deal in Italy.
Pull it off of Italy.
Because we have like this rights management thing built in, you click Italy away and that's it. So you can manage your digital catalog and make money.
And there's a lot of filmmakers out there who do have short films, maybe some award-winning short films that possibly could, even if it's $20 a month, would you pick it up if it was on the floor? That's what I always tell people. Like, you don't need to be making 10, 20, 50, 100,000 a month if it's 20 extra dollars. It takes you a minute to do it. And over the course of the next 3 to 4 years, that might grow. It might go down. It might stay the same. It's $20 that you didn't have to work for.
Exactly.
You know?
I don't understand. I mean, we have even like smaller production companies who have like, I don't know, 20, 25 titles. You know, they produce themselves and they say, some of them are domestic, some of them are from all around the world. We have New Zealand, we have everywhere. And they say, well, we didn't have access to this market before, and it wasn't cost effective to go to AFM after 8 years of this title being around, or 3 years.
Right.
But it's only old titles. We have over 50% of our titles are 3 years and younger, which is I was surprised too. I thought first people would try out with their old catalogs. But no, this is hope after. I mean, you can still do a festival run. You can still do whatever you like. It's just augmenting and helping out, basically, and creating found revenue you didn't have before.
That's amazing.
And we have lots of filmmakers who actually make a living off this now, which makes me very proud.
Stop it, Klaus.
And it's like you don't need, deals. You just, this is where, now, you could, of course, say, well, Klaus, you said earlier you need to, keep doing, yes, you need to market and promote your title. If you just put it up, yeah, all right. But if you do marketing, if you get into the social media, for example, Facebook, it's still, you might hate it or love it, it's still effective to work the social media. And you can recreate an audience or reactivate an audience even on a title which is 2 years old, which is not old, it's just brand new. Nobody's ever, for most of them, it's brand new. Mm-hmm. So you tried your festival run, didn't work, or you have titles even falling back to you after 15 years. Oh my God. But, or three or something. Yeah. This is like, I pride myself in, like, we take everything and only the good stuff makes money. Right. No, everybody thinks they have good stuff, but not everyone will make money with it because it's maybe not as good as they think. But who am I to say? So these are the features, right? We don't curate. You can upload. You don't have to pay. You keep all your rights. You can cancel anytime. And our channels, they love this system because we create because it's technology. So it makes it so easy for them, and there's so little mistakes. And it's very fast. I mean, it used to be many months until your title went live somewhere, including making deals, even longer. Mm-hmm. And now, after the initial upload is done and it's on the marketplace, it can be a few days until it's out and live.
That's amazing. Well, Klaus, I have a few questions I have to ask. I ask all of my guests if you have a minute. I know we've gone.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
No, it's not your fault. I will stop it if it's bad, sir. This is really good information, and I hope everyone out there is appreciative of it. Now, what advice would you give a filmmaker trying to get into the business today?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
There's no better time than now, and become an entrepreneur filmmaker.
A filmtrepreneur, if you will.
Excellent. Did you come up with that?
Yes, I have a whole website, podcast, and a new book coming out.
Wait a minute. Who's promoting that?
Do you not see the hat, sir? Do you not see, don't hate the player, hate the game, sir. Let's move on.
The good news is, look, what we also do is, it's a business. This is not a non-for-profit. It is a business, and I hope it's going to be a big business, because if it's a big business, we can show this industry that the new mainstream is the independent and is the verticals and is the lower medium budget becoming hits. And that's what the audience wants. If we can prove it, which so far it's doing very well, I can give you all the metrics, like growth 8% a month and all these things. But there's an audience who wants to see this, even the most, what others would call obscure and not exploitable titles. So now is a good moment to create film, become the entrepreneur, raise enough funding, but include in your budget or in your time schedule A to Z, including distribution and promotion, even if it means you hire someone to do it. But don't stop by making it and turn your head to your baby and your back to your baby and move on to the next one.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Out of a million lessons? Wow. That's a deep question. Oh man, I learned so many lessons.
The longest, the one that took you the longest to learn.
Actually, that sounds now a bit corny, but to never give up. I'm still not 100% clear. And to say no. These are the longest things. At the beginning, I said yes to everything because I was so afraid they would never ask me again. And now I still do it a lot, and I still think, because it's for the relationship, right? It's for this. If it's nothing you own, meaning, you know, as a creative, don't do it. And that is super hard to learn because we are also under pressure.
Now, what is the biggest fear you had to overcome to get into this business or to do what you do?
Look, we all creatives, and the worst, the hardest thing is to create from scratch. A writer once told me what it is you pour gasoline all over you and you have to light the match. And I'm one who, when I write, I have to suffer and to get this out. And it's terrifying. It is so hard for me to write as you have to find a good balance between liking what you do and hating what you do. Both is possible to do too much.
Okay, fair enough. Now, the toughest question of all, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, my goodness. Here's the first thing. When I started writing major motion pictures, like when I came here about 20 years ago, I virtually stopped watching movies. Because I could... And you don't understand. I was not alive. I was slaving in dark rooms for 18, 16 hours a day.
I come from post-production, sir. I know exactly what you mean.
So to watch a movie on the weekend, no way. Besides, you know, I cannot listen to music. It influenced me while I'm in. I wrote themes which I had written 6 years before that, and I reused them, and I didn't know that. And nobody told me because everyone was just tired. Only years later, I noticed, wait a minute, that's the exact same what I wrote before. Okay, so all this stuff happens. So my movies will not sound like, but what I, okay. I have, first, like one of my favorite things when I grew up was Lawrence of Arabia, believe it or not.
Of course. Spielberg still says one of his best movies of all time.
I did not know that, actually.
So Spielberg watches it every time he watches. Before he directs a movie, he always watches Lawrence of Arabia.
It is like the most inspiring. You just want to be a different person. And that's the movies which, you know, affect me the most, which change your life a bit. Then my 15-year-old son turned me on to a film which was done in the 90s called L'Enfant, The Child. The Darden Brothers. Uh-huh. If you don't know it, must watch it.
Okay.
That's a movie where, I don't know, it was made for $2.50. And gets the impact of a $200 million movie on you.
Okay.
And I don't have a third one. I can just let me think about it. But see, that's my range. Between I'm a sucker for the mainstream stuff, I have to admit, right? I really love this stuff when it's done right. I love E.T. Come on, really? Like, it's
the and pretty much almost, I mean, a lot of things that Spielberg does. You know, he doesn't hit it out of the park every time. But even his foul balls are pretty nice.
Yeah, and I like the, you know, commercial, you know, the early Eddie Murphy. Like, there's stories in there, right? Mm-hmm. We don't do this anymore these days.
Coming to America. I mean,
so if you want the third one, I know it's not like I wouldn't take this to an island and that's the only movie I would watch, but I adore these titles. Because, again, these are stories always like small personal stories with the big backdrop.
That's awesome.
But I've done also, I even love movies I did myself, which is rare. I love this movie called Little Nick or Petit Nicolas, which was one of my favorite story books done in the 50s. And not because I did the music, trust me, I'm usually...
I understand.
But that was well done. The humor was great. And it's totally independently done. And it's something nothing we would really watch in America. But... Mm-hmm. There's a chance of one day we might get a bit more international stuff here so we can actually watch.
I think we're getting to that point. There's so much more stuff around the world that's coming in. I mean, even on Netflix, you're getting shows from Latin America, from Europe, from India that are, you know, I mean, I was watching a telenovela the other day on Netflix.
Amazing, right?
Yeah, because amazing. It was, you know, it was about Celia Cruz. And I'm Cuban, so... I love her music. I was like, oh yeah, this is a great telenovela. And my wife and I were just sitting there, like, I can't believe I'm watching a telenovela, but this is fantastic.
I know you need to move on. I mean, you need to finish this, but when I was in an Airbnb, the guy from before had still logged into his Netflix. So I got the recommendations of him, right? Totally random guy. And that's also a sign for how bad recommendations are at Netflix. I loved them. It was amazing. And he had primed the, you know, it was completely different than me. So I watched this, and now I have to get you the title, a Bollywood action film.
Well, you could just stop right there. Bollywood action film. You've had me at hello. I mean, come
amazing.
On.
Oh, it was just, everything was blowing up.
Oh, I've seen some of them
the
on
guy
YouTube.
Was flying. Boats, race car, even had like a Formula One car somewhere in South of France.
Did you see that little Indian? He's become world famous. He actually did a documentary about him. He's this little Indian dude. Like he's a little person, but yeah. He's like this action star. And he's kicking the heck out of everybody. He's got all the women, and it was just so 80s over the top. Right. They actually did a documentary searching for where he is in the world. I never saw it, but I heard about it. I was like, this is brilliant. This is brilliant.
Yeah. Love, and I love that too. And again, that's to me indie film, right? I mean, they do this for what, $12 million is a high budget there, right? US dollars, right? So amazing what you can actually pull off with good ideas. And if you like have integrity and you must love what you do, and some hate what you do, you think it's complete bull. But yeah, you know,
it's the process.
And I loved it. I would have never watched it. And I gave it to my 18-year-old daughter for 60 at the time. And said, hey, you girls, she was with her girlfriends there, you have to watch this. And they loved it too. So isn't this great how you can – stuff you would have never watched, nobody would show you here in the theaters or, you know, on TV in the old school.
I mean, this is why I love The Room so much. I mean, Tommy Wiseau's The Room. I mean, I can watch that. I can't watch it alone because that's just sad. You have to watch it with a group of people, and preferably if you watch it with filmmakers, oh, it's brilliant. It's so bad. It's brilliant.
Yeah. I know what you mean, right? Yeah, but yeah.
Klausman, thank you. And where can people find you? Where can people find more about Film Hub and everything?
So filmhub.com is the website. There's some information on there. Feel free to hit us. There's a messenger in a little box you can click on. We are on Twitter with Film Hub HQ, on Facebook with Film Hub HQ. Oops, I think. So look for Film Hub. Yeah, and again, what we do is I want to make sure that you understand that we are just like you on the same side. We're creator first, creator friendly. We don't charge you. I'm a filmmaker, right? So I have nothing else in mind but helping those to create and keep creating.
And making money is a good way to keep that brush painting on that canvas.
After all, I didn't stay in Köln, Germany. I came to Hollywood. It's about making money, and you can. I think today is better than ever, and it's getting better. And don't let this distributor screw up, like take you the wrong way. Things like this will always happen. I think it's a big opportunity now that, you know, we're cleaning up here. The industry is cleaning up right now.
Absolutely. Klaus, man, it has been an absolute pleasure. We will have to schedule your composing episode soon because I'm dying to hear all your stories.
There's lots of stories, and I'm sorry for the overtime here.
No, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. Thanks again, Klaus, for being on the show. I want to thank Klaus for this epic conversation about the state of self-distribution, the state of distribution in general, and the business model of how filmmakers make money. This is a very, very important topic. And I need to ask you, please, if you enjoyed this episode, share it with 5 filmmaker friends of yours. Send it out to as many if you can, but at least share this episode with 5 of your friends because, man, this information really needs to get out there. I don't want to see any more filmmakers lose their shirts, lose their dreams, get their hearts crushed by this business, especially if they've gotten the energy and they were able to do the unachievable, which is to make a feature film and finish it and get it out and master it, only to fall. And as Klaus says, turn your back on your baby to move on to something else and give it over to a stranger. So you really need to take complete control and responsibility for your creation, for your film, for your product out there. And this episode really lays out a lot of great nuggets of information, a lot of knowledge bombs helping you do that. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/083. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to filmbizpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening. As always, be that filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.